Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always nice to have you with us. An Empowerment Hour coming at you. First up, Harvard University School of Public Health says that when you take fish oils every day, you reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease-related death. That's important. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal of the American Heart Association. Just a daily dose of fish oil can really put you out of harm's way. Now, it's not just one study. It was 13 randomized trials involving 120,000 adults. And they analyzed every type of cardiovascular effect once you took the omega-3 fatty acids. And sure enough, you reduce your risk of a heart attack, coronary heart disease, all forms of vascular events and stroke. Quote, this meta-analysis provides the most up-to-date evidence regarding the effects of the omega-3 supplementation on the risk of multiple cardiovascular disease outcomes. That's according to Dr. Yang Hu, the author of the study. So if you want to prevent a heart attack and stroke, absolutely. Take 1,500 milligrams twice a day of the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, I go a little further. I would add magnesium, 800 milligrams, coenzyme Q10, 1 to 300 milligrams, high heat index, 42,000, a capsule of cayenne, because a capsaicin in it that increases blood flow, thins the blood, vitamin E in two forms, in one tablet or capsule, the 4 tocopherols and the 4 tocotrienols. That's very protective. And also L-carnitine, which gives energy to the mitochondria of the heart so the heart doesn't go through a shortage of oxygen, which it needs. So one more way that science is proving that we can do this. We can save hundreds of thousands of lives a year. Now, also on today's program, I'm going to share a very important commentary that's brand new. Richard Gale and I have spent quite some time researching it. And the reason why we spend so much time is because the establishment wants to denigrate or disavow any truth in anything that anyone outside of the establishment is writing or saying about what's wrong on any level. If we say that the military-industrial complex, which gets anywhere from 56 to 58 cents out of every dollar that we spend in taxes, which is all told, it's not just $758 billion, it's almost $1.5 trillion, they'll immediately come back and say that's not true, that we need this, we're actually underfunded, every excuse in the world. But everyone in Washington is connected at some level with these special interest groups. And the military-industrial complex, along with the pharmaceutical complex, along with the energy complex, along with the food complex, along with the banking complex, they control everything. So we go out of our way to engage in the highest level of scholarship. So you could take our articles, you could take the documentaries, and take them into a court of law. That's how factually regulated they are. And they're also vetted by a team of lawyers. Today, the barbarians at the pandemic's gate. I told you every day this week I'm going to be doing a different commentary. Five of them this week. Did one yesterday. And if you didn't hear it, go to our archives at prn.fm, download the program. Also today, we're going to share with you some comments from one of the most formidable minds in America, Chris Hedges. For Sheer Post, he wrote an article entitled The Politics of Cultural Despair. He also did a video of it. You can watch it or you can read it. I'll be sharing some of that with you today. Additionally today, I'll be sharing some videos, and one of them is a real eye-opener. I mean, it's brand new information. And a producer was able to get footage of the people involved with the coronavirus. How he got it, where he got it, don't know. But I'm going to share it with you. It's 9 hours and 45 minutes long. So we're going to do like 4 to 5 minutes at a time each day with an analysis. Now, if you go to PRN.fm, you can watch it and see that everything in here is by orthodox scientists and physicians. But these are people more often than not talking about what they're doing, that I don't think it was very wise for them to let the world know what they're doing. You'll see when you hear what they're saying. We're also going to play you some clips. All of these clips are real clips. It's called Wagging the Dog. Today we're starting with Wagging the Dog Part 1. We have Anthony Fauci speaking for just 36 seconds, but listen carefully what he says. Then we have another clip where a group of physicians and scientists are meeting at the University of Pittsburgh discussing genetic engineering of viruses. And listen to how they're talking about this. So, and then we have a physician today, a very strongly credentialed physician, top of the physicians and surgeons. She's a physician. Her name is Dr. Annie Bukacek, B-U-K-A-C-E-K. And she's putting it on the record, and her reputation with it, of saying that the COVID-19 death certificates are being massively manipulated, massively overstated. Well, if that's the case, and if she is correct and others are saying the same thing, that means that the entire effort to contain or help with COVID-19 has been misdirected. We have destroyed people's lives. We've caused people who had never been infected become infected. It's a disaster. And there are lots of doctors concurring. Now, yesterday I read you some names of a new letter from a group of concerned top world-class scientists, Nobel Prize winners, top professors at Stanford, Oxford, Harvard, Yale, all the major institutions. And what I didn't read you, I read you about 20 names. What's behind the 20 names on the same petition? 30,000 additional scientists, 11,000 additional medical doctors, and 540,000 concerned citizens. That's just the first petition, and now it's gone viral, and people all over the world in medicine and science seeing the people who have come forward and put their reputations on the line to push back against this massive gaming of the world public, they're joining. I would expect within the next week, we will have somewhere between 1 to 5 million scientists, physicians, and concerned citizens signing the petition. So it's no longer just a few of us broadcasting, and where your station is so concerned that they have to put a disclaimer, we're not associated with this. Yeah? Well, what truth are you associated with? We have the truth. They don't. So we're going to share this with you. So we have a lot to share today. Let's continue. Another study that is important is from Juntendo University Hospital in Japan. And they found acute cardiovascular disease patients with low coenzyme Q have a greater risk of death during a period of time. And so what they're saying is, and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Heart and Vessels, there's a definite association between long-term mortality risk, meaning death risk, and lower levels of coenzyme Q10. You would think with all the information, all the scientific studies, thousands supporting coenzyme Q10, protecting our heart and protecting the brain, that people would be taken, but they're not. So you're more susceptible of cardiovascular death, carcinoma death, infections, bleeding, and other diagnoses if you're low in coenzyme Q10. That's what they're saying. So take your coenzyme Q10. and that'll help you. From Stanford University comes a study, how stress affects your brain and how to reverse it. What they're saying is this. When the fight or flight stress response was first hardwired into our ancestors' brains, predators were top concern. Okay? But times have changed. It doesn't mean that our genetics have. So what you have to understand is when, let's say, a gazelle or wildebeest or a zebra, common prey for lions and leopards, when they sense a predator, all digestion stops. They have to put that energy into their muscles and their lungs to flee. And that helps protect them. Because you don't want to divide your energy. You don't want to be digesting and at the same time not able to run. Think of what happens when you are anxious, fearful, upset. Your digestion also is not going to be enhanced. So that's why we should eat in a calm mood, ideally in a tranquil mood, a peaceful mood, a nice harmony mood, listening to soft music or music that relaxes us, being in a nice environment, have a nice presentation of our food and not be rushed. Now compare that to the average person, rushing, grabbing a bite. I remember when I was in Spain doing the World Games, and there was a famous restaurants, not just one, but there were about 30 of them, and they were in a little circle around the bay. And this is in San Sebastian, gorgeous place, wonderful people. The restaurants are tiny. In fact, I was there early. I wanted to see how they prepared. A man went over to what looked like a garage door, opened it up, and he had this thing packed. He obviously got it earlier in the day with food. Had a little stove, a sink. It was tiny. I've never seen a restaurant kitchen that small. But what came out of that kitchen was just nothing less than spectacular. Now, there must have been, right there where I was eating, maybe 40 people eating. It normally takes, according to the chef, about an hour to an hour and a half to eat a meal. I looked around, and I was looking how fast other people were eating. They were all Americans. They had finished all their courses in 15 minutes and were rushing. For what reason? I have no idea. They weren't going anywhere. Most of them were the athletes there for the competition the next several days. I ordered some garlic, and being a vegan, I explained I was a vegan. He's not a problem. He made wonderful dishes. But the best dish was a sauteed garlic the way I've never had it in my life. It was golden. It wasn't burnt. It wasn't brown, and it was sweet. This was an elephant garlic, which tend to be the sweeter garlic in any case, but the presentation, the aroma, and so I said, I'm also a chef, and I own a restaurant, and could I take a look? He said, sure. So I went over and I watched, and he and one other person, his wife, were the only two people in this restaurant. They not only took your order, they made your food. But everything was relaxed. Everything was fresh. He told me that he went out that afternoon and he went to the market and he got everything fresh. He does it every day. He's by the end of the evening, everything's gone here. Whatever I have left over, I give to a food person here who distributes to people who need it. He says, I like to start fresh with everything. He said, I go down, which was about 100 feet away, where the boats come in, and he selects the fish and shrimp, whatever they have that day from the Mediterranean. Wow, what a way to eat. But the Americans were hardwired to eat fast. That meant that they were stressed, their cortisol levels were probably raised, they weren't going to get proper digestion, they probably overate and ate too fast, so a lot of the food would not be ready for absorption, so they were overfed and undernourished. Now imagine then that you still have those genes. That's why I always recommend to people I'm counseling, when you sit down to a meal, sit down, meditate, whatever it takes to calm you down, because then when you eat slow and you don't overeat and you don't drink a lot of liquid, cold or hot, with a meal, you're going to get much better digestion. You're going to feel lighter later. You're going to have better absorption and utilization and elimination. Now, the whole point of this is to show you that, yes, we have a fight or flight stress response, and it's hardwired because our ancestors needed to have a greater sense of smell and hearing. They had to be able to gorge when they found some food because there was no refrigeration, there was no stores. So if you found some berries, you ate all the berries. If you found meat, you'd eat the meat. That's what our ancestors did until they could cultivate, until they could grow things, until there was, you know, some of the Sumerian issues of living collectively together and people having different responsibilities in growing food. So never eat when you're anxious, because even though you're not fearful of anything in that moment, your body, if you're anxious, will create a loss of digestion. Remember, we have a lot of stress today. Wildfires in Colorado, the worst in the state's history, in Utah, in California, Oregon, Washington State, thousands, tens of thousands of fires in the Amazon, COVID-19, presidential elections, social injustices. I mean, think of all the reasons that we can be stressed. So we end up one day having what is called a META, M-E-T-A, stress. And it means we have so many stressors from so many places in our life that our fight and flight response is always on. That burns us out, burns our adrenal glands out. So just suggesting that what's going on with the stress will immediately impact your digestion and your immune system. From the Medical College of Georgia comes a study about CBD oil and how it can reduce lung damage from COVID by increasing levels of protected peptides. That's brand new. So what happens is this, and this also helps the brain of people suffering from strokes, seizures, and brain cancer, and lung cancer as well. CBD appears to reduce the cytokine storm that damages the lungs and kills many patients with COVID-19, and this is by enabling an increase in levels of natural peptide called apelin, A-P-E-L-I-N, which is known to reduce inflammation and whose levels are dramatically reduced in the face of this storm. And that's where they found that CBD oil comes in and makes a big difference. So, this was published in the Journal of Cellular Molecular Medicine. Just something more, one more piece of the puzzle to help us face different crises in our life. And finally, from the U.S. National Toxicological Program, a major Orthodox research group, fluoride is toxic to developing brains. So the debate on fluoridation of drinking water, one of the most polarizing, long-running, and highly decibel controversies in public health, has been reignited as new studies find that fluoride is toxic to the developing brain. So now you have the latest study from the U.S. National Toxicological Program. Don't take in toothpaste, mouthwashes, tablets, or treatments, or in the drinking water, fluoride. Oh, and by the way, University of Colorado just came up with a study of how high fructose intake, that's your soft drinks, can drive aggressive behaviors in bipolar and ADHD patients. This is published in Evolution and Human Behavior. We are 20 minutes into our program. I'm Gary Nolitz. With us today, we're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to share the beginning of what is going to be a long-term series, probably over the next 2 or 3 weeks. And this is Wagging the Dog. And the first is a very short, 36 seconds. And what the narrator has done on what he considers important, he has it re-looped as a repeat. So you hear something two or three times, so you get the idea. This is important. Pay attention to it. This will not take long, but it's really interesting. And you can watch this by going to prn.fm and watch it in real time.
And welcoming Dr. Fauci.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. The idea that we are now a few days away from a new administration, there is no question that there will be a challenge to the coming administration in the arena of infectious diseases, both chronic infectious diseases in the sense of already ongoing disease, and we have certainly a large burden of that, but also there will be a surprise outbreak.
The common term bird flu is for the H5N1 virus that was first picked up around 1997. And public health people have been watching this extremely carefully since that time, always concerned that that would be the next influenza epidemic. It kills about 60% of those who it infects. It kills about 60% of those who it infects. However, it has not been able to continue through human transmission. It has not been able to continue through human transmission. In other words, it has not developed the ability to go from person to person to person to person. It's a very serious disease, and we're hoping that it doesn't obtain the ability to be easily transmitted. We're hoping that it doesn't obtain the ability to be easily transmitted.
Gain-of-function research involves creation of pathogens that are more transmissible or deadly than naturally occurring strains. While this kind of research can have important public health benefits, it can also pose serious risks regarding biosafety and biosecurity. In 2014, the US government called for a deliberative process to determine what policy regarding the funding and conduct of gain-of-function research should be. In the meantime, they imposed a pause on gain-of-function research involving influenza, SARS and MERS viruses, SARS and MERS viruses, SARS and MERS viruses, and they imposed a pause on gain-of-function research involving influenza, SARS and MERS viruses, and commissioned a risk-benefit assessment of this kind of research. As part of the deliberative process, the US National Institutes of Health, NIH, also commissioned the Monash Center of Human Bioethics to produce an ethical analysis white paper. The center conducted a review of the ethical literature and analyzed the existing ethical and decision-making frameworks relevant to situations involving risk and uncertainty. The white paper develops a new framework to indicate where any given study would fall on an ethical spectrum, a useful guide for actual decision-making. The white paper was tabled at the White House and will help lift the US block on important gain-of-function research while keeping us safe.
Another really popular topic in the science of infectious disease right now and in the popular literature are what are so-called gain-of-function experiments. And so this has come up several times in several questions in the forum. And so this is research that adds functionality and, in fact, oftentimes increases virulence of existing pathogens. To allow us to study them and study the characteristics they have when they're now worse off, right? But so many of us can immediately, from a sort of sci-fi standpoint, imagine what the costs and the fears associated with these experiments are. But so the important question is, what are the potential benefits are there for these? And if there aren't any, then perhaps we shouldn't be doing them, but we need to understand what the potential benefits are if we're gonna have a reasoned discussion about whether or not these experiments should continue.
So maybe not everybody have heard about it. I think there's been a lot of discussion about it, but I think one of the big issues that precipitated this discussion was it 2 years ago when there were two different labs that genetically engineered the H5N1 influenza virus, the highly pathogenic virus, when there were two different labs that genetically engineered the H5N1 influenza virus, the highly pathogenic virus, that killed a lot of killed most of the humans that were infected, but never transmitted from human to humans, and then they engineered these viruses, that they showed in ferrets could transmit from ferrets to ferrets, which is oftentimes a good model for transmission among humans.
However, it has not been able to continue through human transmission. In other words, it has not developed the ability to go from person to person to person to person. And we're hoping that it doesn't obtain the ability to be easily transmitted.
I think there were two scientific studies that were embargoed for 6 months or so because from being published, because nobody knew the risks associated with this. And so that's just a clarification of an example of what we mean by the gain of function.
I think that example is really important because we as a scientific community don't know what we're doing. So it's really important to... It's true,
I know.
There was recently the formation of the Cambridge Working Group. Marcel Salaté is part of that, and they might gathered together a whole range of scientists to figure out what might we do, because we really don't know whether labs should work on this and how and to what extent government authorities should step in and mandate that this work shouldn't be done, because it is absolutely clear that it's very dangerous work.
So there clearly are serious,
There's a long history. The rationale is pretty simple. If you can identify a specific part, or say a gene in an organism that is responsible for disease, then you actually have a target that you can aim for therapeutics. Okay, and so the classical experiments, and this goes way back, is as long as we've had molecular biology or could do inbreeding of some sort, is to just take a genome and swap genes in one at a time, and see which ones give you the phenotype of disease. And that's how we identified a lot of these virulence factors. And that's what's led to a lot of the therapeutics. And so, you know, that's sort of the background in which these can be beneficial. The transmission experiments get you into another realm because they're really changing the biology of the virus. In one organism. In one case, you're just asking, we know we have a bug that can cause a specific disease. What part of it causes that disease? In this case, we're trying to confer a new phenotype.
So my take on it was perhaps slightly different, in that those experiments were really asking the question, is it possible for this virus, which occurs in nature, to actually become one that transmits between individuals? Nature does these experiments on a routine basis, on a daily basis, 1,000 times a day probably within us. And so in essence, what these scientists, those two groups were asking was, can you do that? Or is it even practically possible for this virus to evolve to that state? That's really important information to have. Mm-hmm. And without that information, we won't be preparing appropriately for that. The embargo was actually motivated more from a sense of, can you provide this information now to certain bad actors who will then engineer this virus to do things that it shouldn't be doing?
Right.
Can you provide this information now to certain bad actors who will then engineer this virus to do things that it shouldn't be doing?
Right.
And so those experiments were already done. They were approved experiments. People went through, but done in very safe settings. with very highly reputed groups. So there was really nothing wrong with the experiments themselves. It was really how the knowledge would be used by bad actors. It was really how the knowledge would be used by bad actors.
Just one part, you're going to hear dozens of parts. And the next part is with Professor Francis Boyle, who's been on this program many times. And he was the one who personally wrote all the law on the suspension and outlawing and making it a federal crime with life imprisonment for anyone who intentionally created a biological weapon. And yet we've been in violation of that nonstop. And you'll hear him talk about where he believes the COVID-19 was engineered and how it got into the population. Evidently, there were bad actors that got it. But what you just heard were individuals, all highly credentialed, all orthodox, very calmly talking about what will be duality, meaning you have a virus that has not infected people, but let's take it and see if it can be genetically engineered and repurpose it by enhancing its infectivity to cross species. Why would anyone want to do that? And then you heard them talk about, the woman was talking about, well, and then therapeutics. That's a code word for major pharmaceutical companies to profit from that. This is not being cynical. It's being pragmatic and just looking at the evidence, as you will see as we unfold all this evidence. Also, in the next clip we're going to play tomorrow, you'll see something that I was not even aware of. And I'm pretty much up on all this. And it's this. It shows you how they're manufacturing deadly viruses to intentionally spray on crops like corn and the food we eat that will then infect a new gene into the crop, and then it'll be more resistant to, let's say, insects destroying it. Now, the insects they're using will then die after they infect the genetically engineered gene, into the food. What was not said in this four-minute clip that we'll see tomorrow is, well, what about the people that eat it? What about the person who won a Nobel Prize for proving, I think they were working at the Rockefeller Institute, jumping genes, a gene that, by altering it, can now jump from a species to another species, including humans, which otherwise it couldn't do. And that's now what we're seeing. But I'm thinking, who pays for all this? And it shows it. The contracts are from DARPA, the Defense Department, what they call dual usage. You're also going to see something that is really terrifying. You're going to see a person interviewing in a laboratory I'm guessing to be two Chinese scientists, because the writing on the outside of the building and what they're doing. They're taking a beetle, a large beetle, and they put an electrode in the beetle, and they program that. Then they take the electrodes out, and they just blow against the wings of the beetle, and it flies. But then they can control exactly what the beetle does. And the guy has a chance to do the same. He asks, can I do it? And therefore, he takes this little apparatus and he blows the beetle, and the beetle's flying in this room, enclosed room, and he then wants it to go right, and he touches the computer right, and it flies right. Left, it flies left. Up, down, anything you want the beetle to do, it will do, because all of its muscular system and central nervous system has been programmed when that chip went into it, when that electrode went into it. You think, okay, so what? Then they talk about how the Defense Department is interested in bringing this in to the soldiers. Ah, you mean you implant a chip into a soldier, electrode into a soldier, and then suddenly you can have them be stronger or faster or do exactly what you want without fear of losing their own life? You want to control all of the body of a soldier? Wow. So these are some of the things that are real It's transhumanism, and it's coming. Next Tuesday night, a full hour on Progressive Commentary Hour with James Corbett unveiling the truth about the Great Reset. It is not what you've been told by Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci and others. It's really bad to the bone, and he will have all the proof. I've seen it. He's next Tuesday. Oh, by the way, tonight on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we got a really phenomenal guest. Edwin Curtin, C-U-R-T-I-N, professor of sociology and theology, Massachusetts College, and he teaches classes in philosophy. And we're going to talk about the search to discover some truth in a nation filled with pathological lying. I think you'll find it very informative, very deep. That'll be tonight at 7 o'clock. Looking for the truth in a country that is so immersed in lying. Now I'd like to share a continuation of our brand new and posted on PRN.fm articles. This is entitled The Barbarians at the Pandemic's Gates. As we approach the end of 2020, it is appropriate to stop, turn around, and carefully and objectively examine how we got fixed into this destructive quagmire of COVID-19, half-truths, full lies, and manufactured medical science. Historically, we are a nation that, more often than not, has sided with the judgments of our public health officials. We have imbued them with a reverence bordering on sanctimonious adulation. The average person has a difficult time challenging the authorities that run our medical system. Consequently, we assume they are more correct than wrong. Unfortunately, the COVID-19 pandemic and our response has been transformed into a great betrayal. The large majority of U.S. population has had their lives adversely affected, some to the point of chronic despair leading to suicide. Trump's greatest economy ever is a lie. It is, in fact, a wasteland of over 122 million Americans closing in on poverty and tens of millions of Americans facing abject poverty. 66 million are food insecure. Over 20 million children go to bed hungry each day, meaning that they simply are suffering from malnutrition because there's not enough food to eat. How much of this economic catastrophe is contributing to the virus's spread and actual deaths? Stimulus packages are only temporary band-aids on what has become a massive gouging laceration. If anyone believes that the United States is economically stable and competent enough to tackle these problems without a catastrophic blowback, they are delusional. Fiscal conservatives are angered that the U.S. national debt has reached $24.5 trillion, while at the same time adamantly ignoring the U.S.'s total debt. How much is that? The United States government owes $82 trillion, $9 trillion more from a year ago under Trump's administration. Unfunded government liabilities are an astronomical $155 trillion. Neither party shows concern about America's increasing personal debt. Mortgage debt, $15.8 trillion. Student loan debt, $1.7 trillion. Credit card debt, $994 billion. Nor the rise in corporate debt, $9.9 trillion. State debt, $1.2 trillion. Local debt in your local communities and cities, $2.1 trillion. When we take into consideration $144.6 trillion in unfunded U.S. liabilities, $20.4 trillion in Social Security liability, and $31.6 trillion in Medicare liability, the nation lingers on the precipice of a total economic collapse. But not everything collapses at once, and not everyone is amongst the rubble of the collapsed system. It is a system that collapses based upon people's power, economic standing, and political persuasion. So those in Washington all of its employees, all of its technocrats, bureaucrats, all of its special advisors and consultants, they'll do fine. But how about you? This is a financial tsunami that can only be curbed by keeping the dollar's printing machines rolling 24/7 until the end of time. There is no possibility in the world that we even pay 2% of this debt, and yet we have borrowed against everything. And that's why so many businesses have had to go out of business. They had no backup capital for working expenses. But not everyone is suffering equally, are they? Especially the nation's 700 billionaires. Average age 65. To the contrary, some are profiting happily during the pandemic. It is in their best economic interest to assure that corporate lobbyists and captive legislators at the federal and state levels are on their behalf working exclusively. And that's what we see. Quite simply, with billions and potentially trillions of dollars being spent on the development and later distribution of drugs and vaccines in the Corona War, it would be foolish, even naive, to expect a higher moral principle to motivate our ship's captain's judgments. Hence, our suffering is their profit. To gain a greater perspective of the dire scenario that we all face, we must pull back and open a curtain to expose something rarely, if ever, discussed. This is a Pandora's box of debt that has become so vast that it will never be repaid. We have been spending money at the federal, state, and local, and corporate and personal levels at an astronomical rate, while intentionally ignoring to realize we are in no position to repay it. For all the uncertainties the pandemic poses to the world, especially in the United States, one thing should now be evident. Our neoliberal capitalist civilization has proven itself to be unprepared for unexpected crises and catastrophes. For decades, U.S. has been falling behind other developed nations in health care, quality of life, life expectancy, wages, class equality, etc. Not only has the American medical system and our federal health system agencies been exposed to be naked, we are also discovering we cannot rely on their statistics, mathematical computer modeling, the FDA's latest approved drug and vaccine, and surely not our decrepit healthcare system gorging itself every day without one thought of empathy for those who are going bankrupt to treat their diseases. And this is all part of an intentional flawed health policy. I don't care who you consider a liberal or even a progressive in Congress, they will not implement a profitless, in effect, nationalized healthcare system. All of them, on the left and the right, want to leave all the profit in the system. Well, then how have you changed it, even if you allow people free access to the care? The quality of the care, frequently outside of emergency medicine, actually contributes to people's demise or ill health. But no one can touch it. It's a sacred cow. Aside from the pandemic's toll on people's lives, there's also its impact upon the national and global economies at large that is rarely discussed. Rather, hopes and wishes are directed towards life returning to past normalcy. We are expected to believe that our addiction to unconscionable consumerism will be restored, that employment will rise and the American dream can again be mentally photoshopped into the national psyche. In short, we are persuaded that the comfort of our illusions and the denial of harsh realities will return. These hopes are highly unlikely, if not impossible. At the height of the pandemic's last spring, former Fed Chairman Janet Yellen warned that the 30% gross domestic product decline is leading us towards depression. McKinsey predicted 40% gross domestic product would be necessary to tackle the economic loss. In desperation, the federal government has already spent $6.5 trillion to frantically keep the economy afloat as a depression far worse than 1932 looms overhead. Some economists believe that this massive bailout is insufficient. Upwards of 10 to 15 trillion may be necessary. But let's look back. In 2008, With one broad stroke, the Obama administration rescued Wall Street, all of Wall Street. Only one company was sacrificed, and that was an insider's manipulation. What was believed to be just the TARP bailout of $700 billion was, in fact, over $4 trillion worth of outlays, including other Fed and Treasury expenditures. The Levy Institute at Bard College calculated the outlays, and they have been as high as $29 trillion. And by the way, that's the number that Bernie Sanders' campaign had quoted. That's how much major corporate interests received. The banks, General Motors, General Electric. Before the pandemic, Trump boasted an unemployment level as low as 3.6%. But in the United States, there are different ways to calculate unemployment. There's the official U3 that Wall Street and presidential administrations rely upon, and there's a more realistic and honest statistic, which is U6, that includes those underemployed and those only marginally attached to the workforce or not at all. And before the pandemic, the real U6 unemployment level was 8%. Now unemployment is skyrocketing. The shadow statistic includes the millions of Americans who have dropped out of work because their benefits ceased or because they're homeless or unaccounted for by the Labor Bureau. When these adjustments are made, the actual unemployment level minimally is 27%. And according to Commonwealth Fund, about 7.7 million works with employer-sponsored insurance have lost their jobs during the crisis, with totals 14.6 million individuals, after including their health insurance to cover dependents. Many of these job losses are permanent. The dark side of American employment has been decades of outrageous layoffs, workers being replaced by automation, downsizing, corporate consolidation due to equity partnerships, mergers, and offshoring of manufacturing, none of which was challenged by Congress, either side. It was sponsored by both Republicans and Democrats. The big originator of the outsourcing was Ronald Reagan, but he was outdone by Bill Clinton and followed by a series of other administrations, all of which, including Obama, sought the benefit of outsourcing. So in addition, tens of thousands of foreign professionals have received work visas and are eager to take the place of middle seniority positions in firms, and they're willing to work for one-third of what the person who'd been there for 20 years or more have been working, and they'll receive no benefits. Good for American corporations and shareholders, not good for local communities and the workers that are being replaced. The system is so utterly, contemptibly corrupt that the millions of people who work full-time or less than a living wage are completely ignored. Hence, most Americans are deep in debt and frequently live paycheck to paycheck. If at all. Even if the lockdown were to end tomorrow, the lights would not immediately switch back on. Throughout the financial news, we're reading headlines of companies eyeing bankruptcy as credit ratings are being rapidly downgraded. Retail stores are being especially hit badly. According to Global Data Retail, over 190,000 retail stores have closed and accounting for nearly 50% of the nation's retail square footage. Many of those are not coming back because of online internet purchasing. The old brick-and-mortar stores, their history. Forbes has listed Dillard's, JCPenney's, Kohl's, Levi Strauss, Macy's, Nordstrom, and Signet to likely go under. Others, Pier 1 Imports, Rite Aid, J. Crew, they're loaded up with private equity debt. Fairway Supermarkets and Niche Organic Grocery, Lucky's, Macy's Capital alone dropped from $6 billion to $1.5 billion since February. This trend had already been rising since Trump came to office, with large chain companies increasingly closing outlets, including Walgreens, Gap, General Nutrition Center, H&M, and Victoria's Secret. For sure, when and if the pandemic ends, there will be far less retail stores. The New York Times predicts very few are likely to survive. And we're not even looking at the hundreds of their vendors that supply these stores with product. They're also affected. With 60% of Americans eating regularly outside the home, the restaurant industry has been hit fiercely. Restaurants employ more minority managers than any other industry, approximately 60%, and employs almost 16 million people. Between 2010 and 2018, it represented the largest number of low-middle-class jobs, meaning $45,000 to $75,000 a year, 300% more than the overall economy. Now, a restaurant apocalypse is underway, with an estimated 20% of restaurant operations going under. Larger chains are far better equipped, and they are simply closing down dining room facilities and only offering carry-out, pick-up, delivery, or drive-through. Smaller independent restaurants are at the greatest risk. Then there are the farms, the concentrated agricultural feeding organizations, and food chain suppliers. In the past, it was very rare to enter a large grocery store and find empty shelves. Now, what you'll frequently see are not empty shelves, but the same products spread on multiple shelves, meaning lack of diversity of products. The pandemic, therefore, is contributing to rising food insecurity throughout the nation. Before the pandemic, Ellis notes, and he is Niv Ellis at The Hill, 37 million Americans were already food insecure. How many do we have now? 100 million, more or less. And 66 million are in dire straits. UN Food and Agriculture Organization expects that the frantic efforts underway by countries to import basic staple foods may launch global food inflation. Also, we might consider the future of 15 million Americans who work in the tourism industry, including hotels, entertainment, parks, museums, etc. It is estimated that 96% of global tourism has vanished in the blink of an eye. State and local city governments are staring at budget shortfalls that will substantially exceed what they faced during the Great Recession. Americans who will either return to a job or seek work when the pandemic slows will be further imprisoned by an economy buried in greater debt. Downsizing will accelerate, along with borrowed money to continue operations while the White House refused to pass a rent holiday. What should the government do? A simple suggestion. The most reasonable suggestion is begin to forgive all debt of small businesses, all student debt, 100%. Refuse all credit card companies to have a debt against the credit of more than 2%. Right now, you'll get a credit card debt more often than not at 18%. But if you miss a payment or only can make a partial payment, it can double. So why not just take it down to 2%? We should have a congressional moratorium that there is no foreclosures. Right now, the greatest burden for the average person is that they're about to have their apartments or homes repossessed. Because even though they were given, if you're a small business, you were given a 3-month moratorium, meaning you could pay your rent, property taxes, common fees later, it's now later, and they don't have the money to do it. But unfortunately, in every one of those, every one of the leases, there's a little clause that says a person who signs this lease is personally obligated to pay. That means if your business closes and you go bankrupt on the business, you're still indebted. Your house, your car, savings, anything else you own, the landlord is going to come after it. That should be stopped with a new law that says all personal obligations or responsibilities for paying the rest of the lease, even though the business closed, is null and void. You should also start to give small businesses interest-free loans for 3 years, providing that they hire, for every $1 million loan, they hire 3 employees and pay them a living wage and give them health insurance. If we did this, we could restart the communities. We should have a Marshall Plan to go into every one of the more than 5,000 ghetto areas, towns and cities in America, and rebuild them using local people inside the communities to bring industry back and have tax-free zones where the business does not pay taxes but employs people from the community. These are reasonable decisions. And after all, if they say, well, you can't be done, well, how about that $29 trillion that you gave away in a few years to major corporations? You cleaned up all their bad debt, took all their bad debt, and you erased it. That's what the Federal Reserve did. Why not do it now for the average American and small businesses? I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.